When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to perpetualchesspod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have another double feature for you this week. We are joined by two guests, a Ukrainian and a Russian chess player guest, each of whom share their perspectives on the Russian-Ukrainian war. I know it can be tough to follow the news sometimes. I myself am guilty of sometimes tuning out the day-to-day happenings of the war, but it's important to stay attuned to it. And of course, the conflict has impacted the chess world in many ways, including with Grandmaster Sergei Karjakin having been removed from the candidates tournament, suspended by FIDE due to his reprehensible statements in support of the Russian unprovoked attacks. It was important, I felt, to discuss the impact it's having on the chess world, and I thought it would be good to get different players' perspectives. So you'll hear from Grandmaster Kirill Shevchenko. He's a bright young chess star, 19 years old, number 92 in the world. He joined me from Germany, where he and some of his family have relocated. He's in between tournaments. He recently played the European Championship, and he's got his first Grand Chess Tour event coming up. So it's like his career is taking off at the same time that his country is in turmoil. It's a tense moment, but it was quite enlightening to hear Kirill's perspective of what the attack was like for him and his family and how he's reacting and his views on how the chess world should react. And after the interview with Kirill, we are joined by Russian Twitch streamer, return guest Maria Elmoyanova, aka Photo Chess. Maria gave a moving interview about how she and other Russian chess players have been impacted by the war. Of course, she is a staunch opponent of the war. She has been outspoken about it. She has done a lot to raise money for Ukrainian causes, but her personal life, as you'll hear her say, has also been upended. She left Russia the day they were attacked, and she's not sure if she'll be able to go back. Her mother is there without a lot of family support now, and she's not sure if and when she'll be able to see her again. So very moving perspective from Maria, but she also had sort of a grounded perspective about the impact, the greater impact that is being felt by Ukrainians. So I think you'll find both interviews moving and worthwhile, as I did. There's not as much chess talk as usual, but there is a decent amount of chess talk. I did want to mention two other things about this interview. Number one, there's more background noise than usual in parts of both interviews. I apologize for it. I'll spare you the details of how it happened. But suffice to say, we try to avoid it. We learn from it. We tried to clean it up as best we can and try to provide better audio quality. But you can hear both guests loudly and clearly. And I also wanted to mention that there is a transcript available. There'll be a link to the transcript in the show notes. So if you decide you would rather read these interviews, that will be easy enough for you to do. Lastly, I'm donating the ad revenue from this podcast to causes suggested by Kirill and Maria. Kirill suggested Care With Team Hikaru, and Maria provided a link to donate to Ukrainian chess player Nastya Rakhmangulova, and she's working to provide direct assistance to those who need it, finding places to stay and food and stuff like that. So I'll put links to those in case you're moved to make a donation as well. So without further ado, let's get to the interviews. Thanks for listening, everyone, and I will catch you all in the interviews. And we are here with the top junior in Ukraine with a rating of 2652. He is a Ukrainian national champion, 19 years of age. He's the number 6 junior in the world, the number 92 player in the world. Our guest, Kirill Shevchenko, earned his international master title in 2016, grandmaster title in 2017. In November of 2021, perhaps his greatest achievement yet, he won the Lindoris Abbey Blitz tournament in Latvia, finished ahead of Fabiano Caruana, Aronian, Dubov, many other heavy hitters. He tied for 20th in the FIDE World Rapid. And of course, being a Ukrainian player, he's been actively playing, but obviously other things on his mind as well. He was featured in an article by Peter Doggers of chess.com discussing what he and a lot of the other Ukrainian top players have been going through. So here to discuss both his career and the Ukrainian national conflict, we have Grandmaster Kirill Shevchenko. Thank you for joining us, Kirill.
Thanks, too.
So, Kirill, it's great to see that you're getting to play. You've been busy, and you've got even more stuff coming up. You got your first invitation to the Grand Chess Tour, which I am excited to discuss, and I'm sure you're excited to play. But if you don't mind, Kirill, I'd like to start with what happened, obviously, with the Russian unprovoked attack invasion of your country beginning on February 24th. Could you describe when the actual attack took place? What was going on with you and your family, Kirill?
Well, actually, the first things I've already heard about the starting war, it was about 17 February. I've heard that something is going to happen, but actually we wasn't sure. I don't usually read some political news, so I wasn't really interested in this. But everyone talked about this, so I decided, okay, I will also be in. I started to read some news, and on 23rd I went back from my gym and I heard some explosions not far from us, and I noticed later it was like a training session, but it was tank explosion, so it was like a military base not far from us. I even didn't know about that, and but my parents told me that it was like training, so it was fine. Next day, my parents woke up at 4 a.m. because their room is located very we are living near the Borispil airport. It's 2 kilometers or 3 from us, so they can literally see a lot of space, and they suddenly saw that some red lights are in the sky, and we heard numerous of explosions, and they we are together packed our luggage, we collected all the documents and some money, and we even didn't think about what to do, because some of our neighbors just left the house and run, but we decided to go to the basement, and we were sitting there about 2 hours. Then explosions started to less and less explode. So after that, we turned on the TV, and actually the president of our country, Zelensky, Vladimir, he already gave a speech, which mean that the war has started, and we decided to think what to do, because it's quite difficult to leave your home, because if you don't know where will you go, because it wasn't possible to leave the country in the first day, because well, already was a document which means that every man from 18 to 60 cannot leave the country. So yeah, that was like a total mobilization of our people, and thousands, maybe, yeah, thousands of people just left the Kyiv because that was the main goal of Russian invasion. Of course, they wanted to. Well, their goal was, of course, to occupy Kyiv, and then, I don't know, started to attack some others' city. So yeah, the first day we just was sitting. Maybe okay, we had some fear, of course. We didn't sleep at all, and next day we decided to leave the Kyiv, because about half kilometer from me, we heard about again the explosion, and the rocket hit the house which is opposite the school where is my brother studying. So and that was that. Yeah, my brother is 11 years old.
Yeah,
and that was really scary, because we was very lucky that rocket doesn't hit our house, because it would be not possible to be alive after that. Wow. So yeah, just it hit a neighbor house, and there was like a very big fire. Yeah, and we saw it, and we decided, okay, we have to leave the Kyiv. Many cars leave. Many people just was in some fear, and many people was scary about that. And when we was in road, we was in center of Kyiv, to the road to leave the city. But when we was there, well, actually, personally, me, I saw maybe everything from Russian, like not weapons, like technique, except tanks. I didn't see any tank, but actually I saw their planes and how they attack the object, some objects, and also I saw their cars with this letter Z, and okay, I didn't notice there was a tank, but after 10 minutes we leave the Kyiv, there was already some few tanks, few BTRs, and that was really scary, because it went from nowhere. Actually, it was like in the forest somewhere, and after that, well okay, when we leave the Kyiv, the road to the Vinnytsia, it's big city where parents of my father was living, and we went to this city, and the road actually was quite normal. Okay, we heard some explosions, but it didn't really happen to us, thanks to God. Well, that is actually about how we lived in Kyiv.
Yeah, and as you mentioned in your interview with Peter Doggers, that journey to the town Vinnytsia, I apologize if I didn't say that right, took about 10 hours. So your family does have a car. You did have a car to get to in order to make that journey?
Yeah, we had a car. Yeah, we have.
Okay. And so you make your way. Obviously, it takes a long time, but we're so glad that you and your family made it out safely. That's a harrowing story you told about, the attacks hitting so close to home and to your 11-year-old brother's school. So once you make it to Vinnytsia, slightly less, slightly safer for the moment, what happened next, Kirill?
Well, the west of our country was a bit safer in these days, so until the end of the February. But from the March, Russian rockets started to hit big cities as Lviv, as also Vinnytsia. So in one of the days, I woke up at 6 a.m. and at 7 a.m. I saw two planes, and my grandmother saw one rocket. There was an attack on the Vinnytsia airport. There was like some military law. There, every seven rocket hit this airport and just destroyed there everything. So I didn't see a rocket, but I saw the planes, which is also not our. And this happened about two or three times in March. And we heard some explosions sometimes, but it wasn't every day. And we finally get some safe and get some calm that we are in safety, and probably if something will go wrong, we are not alone, and we are with our grandparents. So yeah, that was a great decision. And I decided to create help to our people who is in start of a March, many of our big part of our country, for example, east, there was with no food, with no water, with no electricity. So I decided to do what I can, and I had the idea to write to Hikaru Nakamura, and I appealed to them. He has very big audience. He collects about thousands of people who watch him, and he can really donate to the like charity funds. Money from can get to the right hands and to help our people. And thanks to him, he responded me, and we did 12-hour charity stream, which was joining also many famous streamers, and Danny Rensch, and Anna Rudolph, and so on. There was many famous streamers, and after that also after this stream, this charity idea was continued by many of American streamers, and I'm thankful to all of them who collected, I don't know, maybe in total they collected about $500,000, and
wow.
It was sent back to our charity fund, so I hope it went to right hands and actually saved some lives.
Yeah, it was amazing to see the chess community rally like that, and shout out to Takaru and Danny Ranch and everyone who took a part in that. I know it was a large following. And then Kirill, to bring it forward, I mean, you're in Germany with your family now, we should say. You're safely in Germany, and you've been playing chess. So how did you finally decide to leave the country?
Well, we got the chance to leave the country because of European Championship. So that was like an official paper that we can leave the country for official tournament. It's not possible for open tournaments, but it's possible for like some individual, some European, some world championship, and so on. So I decided to... Okay, I didn't even think about it because it looks my parents was in some safety, and I have to continue my career. So I decided to play in European Championship and took my grandmother and young brother with me. So we went to Slovenia firstly, and then I tried to find some some place here, and I was very lucky to find it. And we are here in Germany, so I don't know how many months we will be here, but if I get to, back to Ukraine, so I will have no chance again to leave the country for playing some tournaments. And well, my parents stay there in Ukraine, in Kyiv, and my grandfather too. So that's like the things which is not very, which is kind of upset me. But well, we are communicating every day, so that's.
And everyone's safe for now, Kirill?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And in terms of your grandmother coming with you and your brother, it's hard to even think about trying to make a decision of who would come with you, but how did your family approach that?
Well, my mother decided to stay with father because it's very difficult to leave him. And of course, my father cannot leave the country of his age. He's 48, so he can't leave the country. But that was like not a decision.
Okay, yeah. And your brother, is he thinking about going to school? Like, that's such a sudden change for an 11-year-old.
Yeah, he's studying in his Ukrainian school by online. So that was, they're doing online lessons and they are studying. So we, of course, thought about maybe he might go to school here, but we decided, okay, he was studying in Ukrainian and maybe he will join some Deutsch lessons, Deutsch courses to learn the foreign language. It's very useful for him.
Well, I'm glad that he's able to see the same kids that he knew. That he knew in Ukraine, and it feels probably a tiny bit like it's
the like same atmosphere. Normal. Yeah,
yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And in terms of your living situation, are you guys just renting a flat, or did someone donate it? Like, and are you able to stay there as long as needed?
No, we're renting a flat. Yeah.
Okay. That's good.
We met very friendly people. They are about 70, both of them. They are working in medicine, and they was very glad to see us in their home. And we are also very happy with meeting them because it's quite difficult to be in Germany and do not know their language, but okay, we are learning from day to day and become better. So they help us and we are very thankful to them.
That's great. Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, your English is quite good, but I was guessing you probably didn't have a history with the German language.
I was studying 1 year, but it was when I was 11, so I don't remember a lot, but some knowledge as I have, but it's not too much. So I decided to, okay, now it's time. It's necessary.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Kirill, you're one of the best junior chess players in the world. You know, while all this stuff swirls, you've got quite a promising career. You've just played, as you mentioned, the European Championship, a huge event. From my perspective, it seemed like a decent showing. I'm sure one always wants to do better, but I mean, you held your own for sure, and now you've got even bigger opportunities ahead. So how do you even think about chess in these circumstances, Kirill? Is it providing an escape for you, or are you finding it tough to think about a game with this awful backdrop?
Well, I actually, even already from started when I lived in Ukraine, I decided to not watch the news a lot. So I am, of course, I just stay tuned with some very, very important some news. And my parents also tell me something, but mostly, most of my time, I'm focused on my chess, because I can't really help my people in Ukraine if I just sit and wait and sit and read some news. So I just do my best in my chess. And because, of course, I'm worried about our people. And today I also heard that in the west of our country, Russia sent 5 rockets, and every rocket hit the goal. But on the other hand, I cannot do much about that. So that's why I'm focusing on my chess.
And are you able to put hours in studying, like both from a, like, do you have the time, and do you find that you're able to focus both when you're at the board, Kirill, but also when you're preparing?
Yes, exactly. I have some time to studying and try to make a daily routine, some casual.
That's good. So what kind of routine have you settled into? Are you doing mostly engine work? Do you work on calculation? Like, what's your preferred method of study for, obviously, the high level you're coming from?
Well, as you know, every part of chess is very important. So mostly I'm preparing right now to my opponents on Grand Chess Tour. And of course, I try to improve my skills. It doesn't matter really which part of chess, because every part is very important, and it's hard to say which one is more important.
Yeah, and we should say for listeners, Kirill, he's taking place in the chess.com Junior Speed Championship. We're recording this about 2 weeks before this interview will be released, so we probably won't go too blow by blow on that, but that definitely I've tuned in Friday and rooting for Kirill, and we'll be doing the same in future matches. And of course, the Grand Chess Tour event that Kirill alluded to, May 18th to May 23rd in Poland, and some absolute legends in there that he'll get a chance to play with: Levon Aronyi and Fabiano Caruana, Wesley So, Richard Rapport, Viswanathan Anand, Jan-Krzysztof Duda, Anton Korobov, Radoslav Wojtyszek, and Konstantin Lupulescu, along with Kirill. So just an amazing opportunity to play against these legends. Although you already beat out Fabiano in the aforementioned Blitz tournament, among many others. So Kirill, I was curious if you consider yourself a sort of fast chess specialist, or if that's just another facet of the game for you.
Well, I actually don't have many practice in Ukraine. We didn't have any club, any place where we Ukrainians can come in the training somehow. But I was training by internet when the quarantine was started. So that's how I trained my blitz skills. But I don't know if I'm fast chess specialist. So it's better to other people to judge me somehow. But I just try to improve there, and that's it.
Okay, so but are you, like, you know, obviously a lot of us find speed chess pretty addictive. Are you someone who's playing speed chess for hours a day, or do you tend to play it more for the events and focus more on your classical
game? Mostly for events. I don't play tons of games, so I play usually for training some openings and maybe for some, well, it's like a different approach of training, so it's not the big part of my trainings.
Makes your feats all the more impressive. Now, Kirill, in addition to yourself playing in the European Championship, there was a strong Ukrainian contingent, which a lot of us chess fans were really happy to see so many Ukrainian players there. So I'm curious if you could offer your perspective about sort of the mindset of the other players, and whether you feel an increased sense of unity and, you know, pride in your country, rightful pride in your country. Like, has this brought you guys closer together?
Well, it's of course that situation united us, and we discussed it for a long time, and we was really interesting in each other, who is going to leave the country with his family and who is going to went back. So as I know, no one grandmaster went back to Ukraine because it's obvious it's impossible to continue the career. But some of childs was played there under 18, and they went back to Ukraine, some of them. So for them, it's not a very big problem to get some free from Ukraine, but it's really extremely brave decision for them, because no one part in Ukraine is in safe now. It's impossible to say where is mostly safe place, because rockets hit everywhere. And well, as I know, yeah, many grandmasters are in Poland, some of them in Germany, but I didn't ask a lot, but of course they are in most safe place.
Listeners, we're going to take a quick break and then get back to our interview with Grandmaster Kirill Shevchenko. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by Chessable.com. Of course, by now, I hope you all know that Chessable uses its proprietary Move Trainer technology to quiz you on the chess sequences that you need to remember. Often, it will be an opening sequence, a tactical pattern, or even a crucial endgame, and they've got courses to help you with all aspects of your game. Some of their new courses include Grandmaster Romain Edouard's English Breakfast, which is the reverse Sicilian against the English, and the Deceptively Simple French Exchange by I.M. Sam Collins. So many more new courses coming out practically every day, so be sure to go to Chessable.com and check out both their free and their for-purchase offerings.
Discover why critics are calling Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes the best film of the franchise.
What a wonderful day!
It's a jaw-dropping spectacle that demands to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
We need to go.
Hang on.
It is our time.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
And what about your interaction with any Russian players? Obviously, this is a controversial issue. There's been discussion, you know, like Grandmaster Yakub Agard has been quite outspoken that he feels that all Russian players should be banned from international events while this conflict is going on. And he and others concede that obviously many of the elite Russian players have been outspoken in they don't agree with this war. But nonetheless, if they get to compete, it kind of normalizes the conflict. So I'm curious to hear what you think about issues like that, Kirill.
Well, maybe as you know, we tried to send a letter to the FIDE, where we was disagree with our decision that Russian and Belarusian chess players still able to play in international tournaments, but it didn't work well, and they are still playing, but under FIDE flag. So I don't know. For me personally, I decided to not even be in this team a lot. So. Yeah, it was quite a strange decision, because every sports association banned Russian players, but not chess. Well, but we sent two letters, and no one didn't. Maybe it wasn't good for Russian players. I don't know. But it didn't work out well.
Okay. Yeah, it's maybe FIDE can reconsider in time. And, you know, possibly related, you know, the FIDE head, Arkady Dvorkovich, of course, he's had some light condemnations of the Russian invasion but he's got a long time, you know, relationship with Putin. Do you feel that he should stay as the head of the of FIDE under these circumstances?
No, I don't. Exactly, no.
Yeah. Yeah, and I got the impression, again, Peter Dauger's this article that I'll link in the show notes, but it's a few weeks old by now, but he also quoted many of your Ukrainian chess-playing compatriots, and there seemed to be a pretty strong consensus on that opinion.
Yes.
And Kirill, we had a question from a supporter of the podcast, Stephen Sparks, and Stephen asked, he said that you've been quoted as resisting invitations to move to another federation or perhaps even emigrate somewhere on a sort of more permanent basis. So he asked if that's something you might reconsider or is it too soon? And if you might explain why you've resisted switching federations thus far.
Well, actually, for now, I think it's very bad it's very bad to switch the federation from Ukraine to some else. Of course, many federations propose me, and I also know a lot of U.S. Universities also offered me to stay in the USA and so on. But I decided, okay, it's not time for such a tough decision. And actually, the Ukrainian team is still possible. Still have possibility to play in international tournaments. For example, we are going to play Olympiad if That's everything will be fine. So it's not a great time to even think about it. So I don't really switch now. But as time will proceed, we will see.
Okay, that makes sense. And do you know what the Olympiad team would be? Or is it not gotten that far?
Actually, okay. No, because some of our players stay in Ukraine who can play, but if they will have chance to leave the country, it would be very great.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So do you think it's possible that even some players who are not amongst the top five rated in order to get them out of the
exactly,
country?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. Well, Kirill, this has been amazing. I know a lot of these topics are difficult. I do. I'd like to wrap up just hearing a little more chess talk. I mean, you got to play Alireza Firouzja, you know, your fellow top junior at the World Rapid and Blitz. Again, you got to play all these giants in OTB Blitz. So I'm just curious, what are your most cherished memories so far in your fast growing chess career?
Well, actually, that tournament was, which was in November, that was like a very big surprise for me and a very big pleasure to me to win both tournaments, European Championship and also Linderes Abbey Memorial. Both of them was very difficult out there to participate, but there was some sort of luck, there some... I don't know, probably skills, yeah. And yeah, that is still on this moment, it's the biggest like success in my career, but I'm sure everything is ahead. But that was really impressive, and especially the last round of European Championship when Alireza Firouzja won his game against Shahryar Mamedyarov. We even had some talk with Alexander Moiseenko during this game. And he is very good in mathematics, and he calculated bubbles of both team, and he told us, okay, everything is fine, you're going to win this tournament because you're 2 points of bubbles ahead. But we wasn't sure, because some, like for example, Chess24 was writing, if Alireza wins, then the France won the gold medals. So yeah, that was very like big happiness when we opened chess results and finally we got that we are first.
That's great. And for listeners, I can see Kirill, even though this will be shared audio only, and there's a big smile on his face as he relives this moment. Kirill, do you think that because it was a team tournament with your countrymen, it took on like added meaning?
Yes, I think because we didn't win European Championship from the in our history, in Ukrainian history, that was the only tournament Ukraine didn't win in individual and also in team championship. So we was very happy, of course, because of that.
Yeah, and it's surprising, of course, with Ukraine having such a rich chess history and so many modern legends as well. So I'm glad that you guys were finally able to break through. And obviously, I feel like under the current global circumstances, any neutral chess fan is rooting for Ukrainians in every event. I'm sure you'll have both in team events like the Olympiad and like the Superbat Blitz tournament, you'll have a lot of people rooting for you, which... small consolation given what's going on though. So Kirill, in closing, I'm a, you know, basically a one man shop chess podcast. So, I mean, I do have good amount of listeners. I'm happy to report, but I'm no Hikaru Nakamura, but I would like to make a donation to the, Ukrainian cause of your choice, which can just be to your family members if needed, or if you have a preferred organization as you did in conjunction with chess.com. Where would you direct anyone who wants to help?
Well, I think there is many charity funds where which is our government decided to create. I actually don't know which one is better. Probably if you give me some time, I will find it. But when we did a charity stream with Nakamura, he created his own charity fund on this website care.org, and that was like that is US charity fund. Okay. Probably from that fund already their government sent to our government this money. Probably that's how it works.
Okay. I'll if that link is still active, I'll put it there, and anything else that Kirill sends me, again, we have 2 weeks from when we're recording, so I'll make a donation and encourage anyone who is inspired to do the same to do that as well. But Kirill, as your family, are you and your family okay from a financial perspective for now?
Yeah, thank you.
I'm good. I'm glad to hear it. Yeah, and Kirill, thank you for taking the time. I mean, again, I know it's a difficult time, but we really appreciate hearing your perspective. And like I said, we'll definitely be rooting for you in these upcoming big events that you have.
Thank you very much.
Following this break, we will be back with an interview with WFM Maria Emelyanova. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by aimchess.com. Aimchess, of course, is a website with an algorithm that gathers your games from the major chess playing sites and gives you actionable information about areas to improve or appreciate. For me, my openings are pretty good. My resourcefulness and time management in Blitz need to be improved. They also tell you how your tactics are doing, your endings, your advantage capitalization, and give you specific puzzles based on your own games. So go to aimchess.com if you have not already. Take a look around. You can try it for free. And then if you end up wanting to subscribe to aimchess.com, please use the code PERPETUAL30 to save 30% off of initial subscription at aimchess.com.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we are here with a return guest of the pod, friend of the pod. She is a chess journalist, a chess photographer, a popular Twitch streamer, Russian by birth, although she is a frequent traveler and a citizen of the world. You can hear a lot more about her background if you're not catching her Twitch streams, as you should be, in episode 227 of Perpetual Chess. But here she is rejoining us, Maria Emelyanova, a.k.a. Photo Chess. Maria, how are you?
Hello, Ben. Thank you for having me again. It's great to be here again, and yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, not the best of circumstances, of course, with the Russia and Ukraine conflict. And obviously, Maria, I appreciate that you reached out to come on to discuss that as someone born in Russia. And I'd like to start by asking you a similar question to what I asked Kirill Shevchenko. As I mentioned to you before we were recording, here we are recording on April 25th, and I have already recorded my conversation with Kirill, which listeners will have also already heard. But Maria, when the news of Russia's escalation attack, when the conflict escalated from Russia is amassing troops to Russia is actually launching an unprovoked attack, where were you, and could you just take us through getting that news?
It was around 6 a.m. In my city, in Yekaterinburg, where I was at the time. And I was awake because on that day I was traveling to Moscow and then to Europe in order to make my second jab shot for Pfizer, to be ready to go to the international events without any issues, because back then the COVID passport was still quite important, unlike now. And I was packing to go. So I was just having breakfast as I learned the news. And I remember that I just could not really finish my food. I was just sitting there completely shocked and thinking, how is that even possible? To have a war now in 2022. And I wasn't sure, maybe I'm still asleep. And my mother was the same. She also could not really understand what's going on. She did not believe that it's an attack. She reads a lot of news in Russia and watches television. So she said it's not possible. It's just an operation. And I could not really discuss it with her because I realized that it will damage her more than me mentally to process this and to realize what is actually going on. And I was partially glad that I'm leaving home, that I will not expose her to the real news, even if I don't want to.
Yeah. Now, Maria, it's been reported fairly substantially by, obviously, non-chess media outlets that a lot of the independent media in Russia, I mean, they were fighting an uphill battle to begin with, and they've been outright banned in the wake of this war. So for the people like your mother, it's very hard to really know what's going on, especially if they're just getting their news from resources like television or radio. Obviously you travel a lot, you're well-read, you follow outside news sources, but when you're in Russia, how are you able to keep up with what's actually going on? I mean, again, I know you've left, I know you're joining us from London, but generally, how is it that people like you are able to keep apprised of what's really going on, whereas people from your mother's generation might find that more challenging?
Well, I think the only way is to use VPN. And in fact, in Russia, the VPN is called like a blue evil whale. I'm not sure why is it called this way, but there is a lot of propaganda now in schools and in like kindergartens where they try to encourage the parents to restrict their children from using VPN calling that this is causing them to slash their wrists. That's, I mean, I don't even understand how in the 21st century, a grown-up adult with even a little amount of critical thinking will believe this. But it seems like they do. And as far as I know, it's illegal to use VPN. Of course, you unlikely will be found to be using it. But it still requires some technical knowledge to install it on your phone. And not everyone has computers or laptops. And if you're using specific networks in Russia, even VPN will not allow you to open certain websites. They will be blocked on a network level, not on VPN level. You can still use some more skilled programs to avoid it, but you need to have a special education for that or follow the instructions. So it's all illegal. To getting the real news is basically illegal.
Yeah, and a VPN, of course, a virtual private network, a way to hide where you are in the world so that mm-hmm. if something's banned in Russia, you can still gain access to it. And from what I've heard estimates ranging from, say, 50 to 70% of Russian citizens tend to believe the Kremlin propaganda. Does that ring true to you, Maria? You would know better than anything that I've heard.
Well, when I was giving an interview at the beginning of the war, I think I estimated it around 65 to 35. And I was actually really upset to later find out that it was, in fact, 80 to 20. Wow. Some people even mentioned 90 to 10. But it's slowly decreasing. People do get information, even from the state media, right before the state media will be banned. Because even the journalists who were reporting for years on lies are coming forward and apologizing, and there was very emotional news reported lately how it's their last day, they will not be able to do their job anymore because they have no freedom of speech, but they still want to do this, to do the right thing, to say that it's all a lie. And of course, then the media is shut down and it's gone. But it's enough for people to see it and to actually start questioning, like, if they really believed these journalists for years and now these journalists are saying it was a lie, then it was probably a lie. And then they will start searching. And if the person wants to find, they will find. It's the problem that they don't want to find the truth that is stopping them, not because it's not enough information.
Right. And on the topic of someone like your mother, again, and I appreciate your being willing to talk about this, like, do you see any, again, I totally understand why you don't want to debate it with her. You know, it's a family relationship. And those things, the emotions get involved and it can be tough to break through. But do you see any people from her or her friends that you might be in contact with? Do they have any doubts creeping in, or are they just getting fed the party line and not able to question what they're told?
Most of them are, yeah, they completely believe it and are probably also partially afraid to find the truth. And I cannot really blame them, because this situation that Russia was in for decades, well, regardless of the state system that we had, the political parties, the USSR or the later Russian Federation, there was always a huge amount of propaganda by the state. There was always a lot of lies that we were exposed to since the beginning of the presidentship of Putin. There was a lot of lies. There was a lot of misinformation. And to acknowledge all that means to acknowledge that all your life was a lie and all the beliefs that you had were a lie. And that is very difficult to go through, especially for elderly people. So I don't think they will be able to actually face it, because that will actually make them end up in a complete nightmare. And now they all just sort of accept the difficulties that they are getting and saying, oh, it could have been worse. And that is always the phrase that I heard since I was a child. Oh, but some people live even worse. It's fine. We will get through it. On genetic level, I think my parents, grandparents are used to live in very difficult conditions and overcoming a lot of obstacles. And they never really kind of said to themselves, this is not right. They just accepted it. And that's the problem that a lot of Russian people of the previous generation have. The younger people, they get more critical thinking from the West. They can go travel and see how the other world lives. And they realize this is not the way for us to live. We should not live like we do. We were put in this bubble to live like this, but we don't want to. While the older generation is just accepting it without questioning. And I don't think this is going to go away. Even now with the war, even if it lasts longer, I think a lot of people just on a genetical level have this problem. You just cannot change them. That is a big problem that we have. And unfortunately, going out in the streets and protesting will not change that, I don't think.
And Maria, you mentioned protests. And one thing I wonder, you know, from the outside looking in, you hear these terrible stories. Obviously, people who are outright protesting the war are being arrested. You also even hear stories of people in Moscow holding like blank signs. If they bring a sign that doesn't say anything, even in that case, they are often arrested. Now, what you don't hear, or at least I haven't heard as often here in the U.S., is what happens after they get arrested? Have you heard any stories or reliable reporting about are people staying in jail? Are they being released that day? Are they being released in a few days? Does it vary? What have you heard, if anything, in that regard, Maria?
Well, I know that some of the people who were arrested, I did follow some of the stories. They have been released. I think the main idea behind the arrests is to scare, well, first of all, of course, these people, to scare people who saw it, to have more people scared to go in the streets. But I've seen the same people going out to protest again on purpose, to send a message to others that I'm not afraid, even after I went to, well, it's not a jail, it's a pre-arrest area, that yes, I'm here. They have no interest in me, at least yet, but I'm willing to go again. I'm willing to get arrested again, and so should you. And of course, for me personally, being outside of Russia, to tell people to go and protest would be very selfish and I don't want to do that because it is dangerous. I don't know if everyone was released. I don't know if everyone is safe and not injured or anything. But I know that they were also arresting random people, completely random people, going just happened to be in the wrong place in the wrong time. So even if you are going to the shop to just buy some food, but they see a backpack, they might arrest you. So to sit at home and just to be scared all the time is also not an option, at least for me. But what exactly to do? I'm afraid we don't have a very strong opposition leader right now who could lead all these people in the right way. So I think the only way something will change is when we hit this point of completely unsustainable crisis, when so many people lost their jobs, so many people have no money to feed their families and cannot leave the country and have no means of surviving, that these people will start going in the streets because they have nothing else to do. If this point of no return happens, then our government is in trouble. Until then, I think they will be able to scare enough people to not to go out, and also encourage enough people to report on their neighbors and even their family neighbors. I've heard about that they would report on their family members about wrong beliefs, about Western propaganda and so on, and write them as a foreign agent and so on. So that's like a big throwback to the Soviet times.
Yeah, it is. And Maria, how do you think about the risks of speaking out yourself? Now, as you mentioned, you're outside of the country, but presumably, I mean, you've got family there. I would think you'd like to go back at some point. Did you have thoughts of keeping your thoughts to yourself, and how did you think about that?
Well, of course, I'm very scared of not being able to go back home, maybe ever again. I do have family. I do have mother. I want to see her again, but for me to keep my thoughts to myself would be to stop being a human. I just cannot imagine that I can pretend that nothing is happening and just sit in my shell and enjoy my free life when so many people not only are being killed, but being tortured, being raped, and it's almost like they are making fun of a human life and think they are superior over, well, it all sounds really like 1941, right?
Yeah.
And it basically is. And a couple of years ago, I went to Auschwitz, and I've seen it all with my own eyes. I've seen what's been done to the race, which was considered not worthy of living, and that's what is now happening to Ukrainians. And I just cannot think of myself as a human being if I let this happen without saying anything, even if this would mean that my life will change forever and I might not see my family again.
Wow. And just on a personal note, I can't help but wonder, Maria, we talked about your cats in your last interview. They often make appearances in your stream. I'm guessing they're back in Ekaterinburg as well.
Yes, they are with my mother, and my only hope is that they keep her enough of company to not to feel completely lonely, because our family is not that big. Mm-hmm. And my brother also left the country, and she's basically alone. And I really want to see her again, but at the same time, I think she's safer away from me and away from my thoughts and beliefs and statements. And I hope it will stay this way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you say, unfortunately, conditions continuing to get worse could ultimately bring an end to this. So I'm not near-term optimistic, I'm sad to say, but long-term, maybe this can help bring about change. And if that change were to come, then hopefully you and your mother both would be able to travel freely with as little, you know, we just hope for as little of a human toll as possible. But Marie, I also want to talk about just sort of the chess worlds. I mean, obviously you're a big part of the chess world, mm-hmm. and you're, you know, quite friendly with a lot of the top players in the world. And I think a lot of Russian players in particular. During our last interview, you were joining me from Jan Nepomniachtchi's house as he began to train for the World Championship. We've seen a lot of the public statements. I've been, you know, 95% happy to see most of the statements from top players condemning the war and calling it what it is. Have you also had conversation, and also we should mention you and your team at chess.com, as Kirill spoke about in our interview, just raised an incredible amount of money, and it's been great to see the chess world rally around the cause. But I'm curious what other interactions, if any, you've had with other prominent Russian chess players.
Well, of course, I spoke to a lot of chess players from Russia, and I prefer to not to mention specific names, but what I can say that a lot of them, whether they are in Russia or outside of Russia, are completely against the war. They don't want this to be happening. They want to stop it. But unlike me, I cannot call myself a professional chess player. This is not my main source of living. I can speak freely, and as I mentioned, I'm taking I'm accepting what might happen to me and my family. For chess players who are exposed more in Russia, since they have their families there as well and their assets, and they keep traveling between the countries, between the tournaments and the home countries, for them to speak, it might mean to lose everything. The ability to travel, the ability to earn money for their family, for their households. But a lot of them are against the war. And to divide them just because they spoke openly or not, I don't think it's very fair, because everyone is in very different circumstances. Some of them had enough savings to leave and take the entire family with them to settle in Europe. And some of them did not have this money. And some of them are older and can take such decisions. And some of them are much younger and simply are not ready for this. And you cannot really be ready for this, to flee your country. Even me, I'm over 30 years old. And I'm sometimes really scared and I cannot stop crying, because in just one day or one week, my entire life changed. And I sometimes think, oh, I should have taken this item from home. I should have taken this. I should have taken these documents. I might need them for some visa application, and I couldn't, and I might not be able to take it, because even correspondence is stopped between Russia and other countries. Plus the fact that I'm, by doing what I do, I break countless number of laws every day. to accept that is very difficult. We were not brought up for this. We were brought up to just play chess. And to demand of chess players to have an open stance on the war is not fair. It's just not fair on anyone. And I'm not saying that what happens to us is the worst. I'm not trying to say that Russians are the victims. No. Of course, to have your house bombed, to have your family killed or tortured is just the worst what can happen to you. But it's unfair on everyone, both Russians and Ukrainians.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's good that you point out that obviously the impact on Ukrainians is even degrees higher. But I mean, it does strike me hearing your stories. It really puts a personal note on just how difficult it can be for Russians as well. Now, Maria, I did want to clarify what you meant when you said that you're breaking laws daily.
Yeah. So during the first week of the war, there was a few new laws appointed. I probably don't even know about all of them, but it's not allowed to mention the word war,
right,
in any social media. It's not allowed to spread out fake news. And of course, you can you can put a lot of things as fake news. I cannot even be sure which one of my tweets or social media posts or even streams can be considered as Western propaganda, as misinformation, as spreading the lies about this special operation, quotes. But I have a lot of Russian people coming to my streams, even when I stream in English, and saying thank you for being the voice, because we cannot have it. And they are probably even worried to write these words, even if it's in English, even if it's on a platform that is not yet banned in Russia. But they say that we cannot do it, and you can, and thank you for that. And I do think that by doing what I do, I can help more than if I did go for a protest in Russia, for example, because that is very limited act, while here I have more possibilities to speak out for at least a small minority of Russians. But since they put so many laws and restrictions on us, we probably have a power. Otherwise, they would not have done that. And regarding the other laws that I might be breaking, well, as I said, I cannot be sure about all of them, but there is something about financial, like income-based laws that, for example, if you have jobs or contracts outside of Russia and you get foreign assets, you are legally obliged to transfer 80% of those to Russian bank and convert into rubles. And you're not allowed to withdraw or take out any foreign currency from a Russian bank right now. So a lot of people also get their assets stuck there, so they cannot leave. The whole idea is to not allow people to leave and have more freedom to speak.
Yeah, it's also depressing. You know, Maria, as we wrap up, I would like to talk about something slightly more upbeat, which is just all the money that you and Hikaru and Danny Wrench and Eric and all the team from chess.com managed to raise. Kirill was quite appreciative. You know, I had seen a tweet where from one stream, you guys raised it was like $130,000, but he mentioned $500,000 in total. Just absolutely incredible. So I was to sort of finish on a brighter note, could you walk us through sort of your involvement in that. And I know that in another media appearance you did, you mentioned that you began trying to do some streams to raise some money in short order once you got settled from this awful news.
Yeah, as I mentioned in an interview with Philip Borel Fonteles, once I kind of went out of this state of kind of being hit with a bag of sand, you know, like when you just don't understand what's going on. It was about 2 days. I was in Croatia. I went there just to do my shot of vaccine, which of course at that moment already felt like something completely irrelevant to my life. I was in a hotel room and I felt like I have no purpose. I don't know what to do now. And I just went live and I started talking about this and I decided to start raising money for... I didn't even know at the time where exactly I will send the money. I just wanted to talk about it. And people immediately started donating. And I was first accepting it just to my own wallet on PayPal. And a couple of days later, I decided to start doing the charity with Direct Relief, who helps with humanitarian support in Ukraine. So then later, some of the funds which I was raising on my own, in my own wallet, I was sending them to various volunteers in Ukraine, helping to specific people, specific stories. Sometimes I would find people on Instagram asking for help and send there. And then I also donated to Direct Relief myself. I also sent the money, around $1,500, to the CARE charity together with Hikaru during the stream. I was trying to also like bring more people to the stream while the other chess players were on the stream with Hikaru. Of course the stream with Hikaru was just amazing in the reach, in the amount of support, in all the messages I was getting during the stream and the others, all the support that I got from other streamers saying, I always felt like me speaking on the stream of such a big reach and saying about my life and my struggles is just not fair, because at least I am safe. At least I don't have an everyday fear of a missile landing in my house or running back to the bombshell like Anton Korobov did, or Anastasia Rakhmangulova did, or Kirill Shevchenko, or so many others, or Natalia Zhukova, who is fighting on the front lines with her fellow political members, sports members, people from all over Odessa region, just teaming up to help volunteers and soldiers. I am not in this situation and I cannot complain about what I'm going through, but people were still coming to support me and to say nice words. And of course that was very, very moving. And I want to keep helping. In fact, I decided to start putting aside part of my income from Twitch every month. I don't know for how long, but I think it will be at least the next 6 months. I want to start supporting mostly children, but also the families of those who lost fathers or brothers in the war in Ukraine, wounded children or kids who became orphans or need any treatments in Europe, because it will be a prolonged effect. A lot of people will need help even after the war is over, whenever this is. And of course, the sooner the better. But they will still need help. It's not going to be over. They will need to find homes, to find... establish a new living in the new place in completely foreign country where they might not even be able to speak the local language. And I wanted to get involved with organizations which help them and volunteer for this. And I hope with my community, and my community was very supportive of this. I actually announced it a couple of days ago on my stream, and they said that they really want to help and they really want to get involved and to listen to these stories, because it's real people, it's real stories, and I want to help telling them and make some impact in their lives.
Yeah, well, again, I mean, it's awful circumstances, but I commend you. I mean, it's I commend your bravery in speaking out and your generosity in both your time and the income you're earning in terms of directing it towards good causes. And Kirill had left me with a couple suggestions of charities that listeners can donate to, and I'll be donating the proceeds from this episode to those charities. But Maria, if you have any particular ones to add, you can let me know, and it doesn't have to be now, but you can let me know, and I'll include those as well. Another question I had, Maria, because I did ask Kirill, and you know, we haven't talked about chess obviously as much as we usually would on this show, but one of the sort of you know, topics that arises from this is to what extent Russian players should be punished for the sins of their country. Like, should they be allowed to compete internationally? A lot of, you know, this is a contentious topic. A lot of people have strong opinions. I'm just curious, as a Russian and someone who's friends with a lot of elite players who are kind of caught in the middle, what your perspective is on this topic, Maria?
Well, it's hard for me to speak. Well, of course, I am born in Russia and I was competing under a Russian flag in youth tournaments. But I've changed my federation to English 2 years ago. It was completely unrelated, obviously, to the war. It's just because I spent so much time in the UK, I decided to switch so that I have some chances to qualify for the team events, and I did, and I performed very poorly. And I'm better as a streamer and maybe a coach sometimes. So for me to speak on behalf of Russian players is probably wrong. It's probably, it's just unfair for me since it's not my main source of living. But my personal opinion on this is that's probably the easiest way for the international chess community is to not to have Russian players competing on for titles, for European championship titles and world titles. And of course, I might get a lot of angry messages after this, but I just cannot imagine having a Russian player winning European championship and having it announced. And we cannot play the anthem anyway. And it's going to be overshadowed by the war anyway. Having this title will not bring as much satisfaction to this player. And we all are going to be affected for years and years. But the next two probably are going to be the most crucial for the Russian chess. I think it's just much easier for everyone if Russian players will be banned from participating in championships where they can win international titles. While the open tournaments probably should just divide into those who have Ukrainian players and those who have Russian players competing. And to not to have them not only meeting over the board, I think it won't really help. If they are in the same room, it's still very, very difficult and it's impossible to focus on chess. And I would have said this about any other country as well. It's just so much easier if the country that is at war should be sanctioned. And I say it as a Russian, we should be sanctioned because this is the country that is attacking. It's not one person who is going to a war. Yes, he inflicted the war, but it's Russian soldiers who are killing the Ukrainian citizens and soldiers, obviously, as well. But it's a lot of civilians who are being harmed and killed. And to have these players participating in the same event, it's just not going to be a sport. It's not going to be the right conditions for people to play in, even if they are from other countries. It's just very it becomes much more political than sport. So I think the harsher measures, I do not oppose them personally. But again, for me to speak about this is much easier because I'm not a professional chess player.
Yeah, I mean, it's an admirable stance on your part. I do think, you know, I've gone back and forth on this, but I think I reluctantly agree with you. I mean, when I start to think on a personal level of someone like Alexander Kostyniuk, who's been an amazing ambassador for the game and quite outspoken, Peter Svidler, of course, you know, nicest guy in the world, and obviously has made his feelings known as well. It's hard to think about the personal impact that it has on those, but like you say, there's all kinds of inconveniences that you've had to deal with, that many others have had to deal with, even if they're not directly involved. Yeah, and on the topic of soldiers being also culpable, obviously that's true as well. But I mean, you do hear, you know, you hear stories of the information that they're being told, and these are just young kids being led off to war, and they're, you know, being sent there under totally false pretenses, that it's not so easy for them to understand, given the information they're being given. So there's just so many victims, and some of the victims are even aggressors in the war. But yeah, it's just an awful situation all around. What can you say?
Yeah, absolutely. You cannot really divide people into those who do it willingly and intentionally and those who are being misinformed. And of course, they know that if they turn around right now, they probably will be shot in the back if they try to desert the army and to say, oh, you should have done it anyway, because killing others is so much worse than to be shot yourself. But it's easy to say when you sit in a sofa, like a lot of people would come and say, oh, you should just go outside and protest. But you are giving up a lot in 1 second. And nobody is born prepared for this. You have to come to this conclusion on your own terms and in your own time. And this moment, I hope it will come, this moment will come when the majority of Russians will go to protest. But it's no one's business to ask them to do it and to say that otherwise they are bad people, because there is no just like black and white, like in chess. In this war, you cannot say that all the Russians are evil, and you cannot say that all the Russians are completely innocent in this. We are in part all responsible for what was building up throughout these 30 years, because obviously it did not happen in one day. There was a lot of propaganda, and a lot of people were not talking about it because it was just convenient, or they had other things on their mind. And you can say that all of us, me and a lot of us, are responsible. But also, of course, everybody has their own lives and they were focused on other things. And there is always enough of guilt and also enough of circumstances. You can say that you could not have done enough to stop this. But it just should not be happening. That's it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good note to end on when it comes to the war. As you've said, we'll hope against the odds for some sort of speedy resolution with minimal additional damage. But, you know, it's unfortunately, that's not the most likely scenario. So, Maria, last thing before we let you go, what's going on with your chess journalism and Twitch streaming? Like, are you going to be covering any events? Are you streaming as often as ever? Are you managing to sort of maintain a sort of, or at least move towards resuming a regular professional life?
Well, I've been trying to settle my own life, to find a new place to live, and I don't have it yet, but I'm working on it. I'm working with lawyers and looking for options, because it's obviously difficult to continue professional career when I'm still a Russian taxpayer. And to start with, I don't want to pay Russian taxes, because we all know where this money goes. So far, I don't have any other solution of a permanent residence, and I really want to fix that. But with streaming, it's I'm streaming more than I probably ever did. It's really redeeming to be able to talk to people and to let them know how it is to help those in need. At least some people in need in Ukraine. And I'm planning to do more charity streams, hopefully again with Anton Korobov and maybe some other players. I'm exploring new ideas how to make myself more useful. But I'm also planning to attend various international chess events, like Norway Chess, like Candidates and the Olympiad, and the more events in the future as well. I'm just trying to balance out the problem of the permanent residentship, streaming, and my chess photography career.
Okay, well, Maria, we wish you luck. Any country would be lucky to have you. So, obviously, if any listeners have any have any connections, you can find Maria on Twitch and on Twitter. Anywhere else, Maria, where people could reach out to you?
It's Instagram, it's Twitter. My email is quite known. It's also written in Twitter. They can reach me out at maria@chess.com. I'm not expecting anyone to help. I'm sure I'm not in the most difficult situation here. At least I know the language enough to be able to make my ways around. I will be more happy to help others if I have a chance to, because so many people will need help. It's not going to be over, and I just want to let people know that you can always help, even if it's a very small amount. You can always make a difference in someone's life, and don't worry if it's not. Don't think it's not enough. It's always enough. Just thoughts are helping as well. And I'm sorry that this was quite long. I know sometimes I can get quite carried away with my thoughts. But thank you, everyone, for listening.
No, they were amazing insights. It really, really lends a personal perspective to, obviously, we all see the gruesome pictures coming from Ukraine, but to hear the human element of the struggle of an enlightened Russian, at least Russian-born citizen, and we'll see where that goes. But thanks again, Maria. Really appreciate it. And please be safe and keep up all of the noble fundraising that you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again. And yeah, I hope to hear more beautiful stories from your podcast.
Thank you, Maria. Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Beneficial1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next episode.
Social Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.